Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
Brexit means Brexit.
My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country.
Hello and welcome to Mid-Atlantic, the show where we look at the news and the views from one side of the Atlantic from the perspective of the other. At least that's what we do normally. Normally we look at US and UK politics. And what I like to do is have a group of pundits, a group of friends with me to look at the main news stories from either side of the Atlantic. Could be Britain, could be America, sometimes even Canada. And we run the rule over it from the perspective of the other side. That's what we do normally. But we're living through one of the most pivotal times in modern history. This week we've seen the fall of Kabul. And what this has sharply brought into focus is American foreign policy since the accession to office of Barack Obama. That fundamentally, America has tried to detangle itself away from foreign engagements. Hiding this all through various policy pronouncements such as America First or drone strikes was actually the retreat of American commitment. And what has happened is a spectacular denouement of that policy with the fall of Kabul. So what I want to do is not run the rule over why America was there. We know the reasons why America was there or what America should have done in the last 20 years. What we want to do is look forward globally for the next 20 years, because I think we're about to enter, in effect, the 1920s and the 1930s in terms of global instability. We don't live in a unipolar world anymore. We live in a multipolar world. There is no global policeman. America has abrogated that responsibility and has soundly been defeated in the streets and in the mountain passes of Afghanistan. So what we want to do is look at what are going to be the effects on geopolitics, migration and refugees, and specifically climate change. I'm sure there's going to be many other topics and areas which we could discuss, but fundamentally, for the sake of the podcast, we only have 1 hour. So what we're going to look at is political uncertainty in institutions. Why have we lost faith in them? The US and China, what this means in terms of trade and global hegemony, the rise of India and its tensions with China, the relevance of Europe or not geopolitically. Has Europe massively now shrunk? We are going to look at the Middle East and what the American defeat means immediately for that region. We're going to look at discontent in Latin America. We have the rise of Bolsonaro and anti-establishment politicians there also. But also, we have the rise of Africa with a landmass which is bigger than India and China and the US and Europe combined. Africa will become a rising player in the next 20 years. We're going to look at migrants. The effects of climate change are going to push the world into many crises to do with migrants and refugees. And I also want us to look at climate change. So those are the broad outlines. We have on stage my good friend, Reblacka for the Blacks. We have AB, who is one of the stalwarts on Mid-Atlantic. We have my good friend Kelly Saunders. We have Ben Mendelssohn, who is in Burkina Faso right now. We have Bilal Wilson. We have Aaron Fisher. We have Hajir, who is over in the great state of Minnesota. And we have Amina Yasmin, who is an expert in the Global South, but also in urban planning. And we expect many more people to join us before the end of the podcast. First off, I'm going to quickly go through and ask you, because the starting point is the fall of Kabul. What I want is quick takes from everybody on stage. Reblacka for the Blacks, you're up first.
Really quickly, so I spoke about this at length yesterday. What is American foreign policy? You know, are people willing to open up their eyes to the destabilizing nature that that has too often, unfortunately, been the byproduct of American foreign policy? If you look at Haiti, you look at Cuba, you look at Chile, Guatemala. People can read the economic hitman. They can read the People's History of the United States to get a clearer understanding on what America actually does. So once you see that, you're able to contextualize and maybe not be as shocked in this kind of like out of nowhere cognitive dissonance. And you'd be like, oh, yeah, this is America.
So this is America. Apt point to end on. AB, your hot take, sir.
I wouldn't necessarily call it a hot take, but it would not surprise me if America is back in Afghanistan at some point within the next 5 years. That's pretty much where I'm at. I think that this whatever negotiations were done between the United States government and the Taliban, I think that there is a possibility that, you know, further military action will come in the event that the Taliban does not go forward or pull through. But I also don't really believe that the United States will keep its end of the bargain as well. So it'll definitely get messy.
Kelly Saunders.
I hope you can hear me. My hot take, I guess, on all of this is that right now, the general public in America is taking a happy vacation from talking about COVID, and it's not going to last long.
Ben Mendelsohn.
Yes. Hello, everybody from Ouagadougou. It's a very interesting question. I look back at what 20 years ago was compared to, 2001. I don't expect things to be all that much different. I think with the challenges of technology, the changes our conversation is going to be a big issue. I think China and the United States will be running around in circles, sort of balancing each other in both their progression and their mutual destruction. I think I'm sitting in the middle of Africa, and it's just has such huge potential. And in terms of an area with the most rapid possible growth, I do think that Africa will be in a much better place than it is now. Whereas I see the developed world sort of spinning around, just, trying to get out of their own way.
Thank you, Ben.
And that's my quick take.
Bilal.
Thanks. And I'll be brief as well. I just have two hot takes. First of all, I think it's to me pretty apparent that our 24-hour like media news cycle is not really equipped to handle like a complex foreign policy conversation where you need nuance, analytical analysis, and things like that. I think that's been pretty clear that I've been seeing. So that's kind of like the first hot take. The second hot take, from my perspective, is I'm not necessarily looking at, let's say, 20 years from now in Kabul. I'm actually really interested to see what happened in the next 20 days. 40 days, like more of a short time horizon. In particular with, I'm kind of watching, let's say, statements from certain countries. I'm interested to see, what Pakistan says, or by the way, what China says. I'm interested in more really, really short term, because the way foreign policy can work, so many things can happen over just 5 or 10 years. I mean, the Arab Spring was was, what, 2011, right? And, you know, you had many governments fall just in 1 year. So for me, I'm looking more of a much shorter time frame. So those are my two hot takes. One is on the media and one is just on interested in the next 20 to 40 days and what some, what I think influential countries or who might have some influence with the Taliban might be saying.
Aaron Fisher.
And thanks, Rayfield. You know, my hot take is that nearly 200,000 people lost their lives. It's going to cost roughly $10 trillion. There's countless people who have been displaced and are going to be displaced. And, you know, many more who were wounded and all kinds of other impacts. And my big question is, for what? I really can't answer that question, and I haven't gotten a good answer to that question from anyone. Certainly not any answer that satisfies me. And I would hope that this signals an end to a type of American militarism that has really torn apart lots of countries around the world, and that we, that those of us who are Americans, would advocate for our government to move away from those, that kind of American militarism or adventurism, as they call it.
All right. So what we're going to do is, considering that, Ben, you are in the middle of West Africa, you're in Burkina Faso. First off, we're going to turn our attention to Africa. Africa has a landmass which is bigger than India, China, the US and Europe combined. And it has a scale of resources which no other continent can actually match. Ben, first question to you. Will the US retreat in Kabul only accelerate what's been happening before, which that African governments, regimes will be much more disposed towards Chinese investment, Chinese initiatives, just like Ethiopia, Angola, etc. Does this mean that China has a much wider canvas to play with economically in terms of economic development in Africa?
The answer is yes. Absolutely. You see it here very much. The Chinese are pretty much everywhere. They're investing in infrastructure. They're investing in the economy. The Americans actually have brought in resources and a bunch of money, but they're very slow, for good reason, to distribute the resources, because they're very afraid of corruption. The Chinese, not so much. They're moving very quickly. And I think it would be hard for the U.S. right now. And I know in other places, in Kenya, in Senegal, and other areas, the Chinese are pretty much everywhere. So the short answer is, I believe China has a much greater potential to control, to have a larger foothold than the developing countries. I mean, I'm sorry, the like France and the United States.
Ben, we've spoken once or twice before on the app. Give us a sense of how you've seen Africa change in your time since you've been based in Burkina Faso.
Well, truthfully, we've only been here for about 8 months. So this, I'm still getting used to it, but I have studied a bit. Prior to this, we were stationed in Uruguay for 3 years. So I probably know more about South America. But with that said, Burkina Faso, you know, like anything else, from the outside world, Africa looks like one big country. But once you're in here, there are very distinct societies. Even within Burkina Faso, there are 51 distinct tribal ethnicities. So,
thank you, Ben. Thank you.
Okay, I just thought I'd mention that. And so, what happens is that it depends on where you are. You know, we're right next to Mali and Niger, which Mali is essentially a failed state. They have all of their own issues, but you go across the border, and even though we have a lot of challenges here in Burkina Faso, the culture here, the music, the people are amazing. And I see, with just a little support for their institutions, I see them being able to produce, to develop a really successful institutions. And the answer is, it depends. But it's amazing. It's like I said, you can really see an amazing potential to accelerate, you know, for the good. I mean, it just south of here is Ghana, which has a really thriving, growing economy. Rwanda is they call it the Singapore of Africa. Things are moving very quickly in a positive direction. So it's something that we all need to keep an eye on, and I think people in the West need to learn about it more, because it's very important what's going on here.
Lola, you are a Nigerian American. Nigeria is forecast,
otherwise known as Nymerican.
Absolutely. Nigeria is forecast to be in one of the 10 biggest economies by 2050. What are the inherent problems which are maybe hampering Nigeria meeting that potential right now?
Corruption. I mean, I hate to be that basic about it. I'll briefly share an anecdote. And Ben, it's so amazing to see you here and hear about the work you're doing in the region. So thank you for that. But last time I was in Nigeria is about 2 years ago now, for a wedding, actually, between a friend who's Nigerian American like myself and her now husband, who's a white guy from the States. He visited for the first time, so we were touring him around and getting to the point of the story. One of the things one of my uncles took us to go do was sort of observe all the opulent mansions in the Victoria Island region of Lagos, which is where a lot of the government related individuals who have obscene amounts of money for some, you know, reason that I think makes very little sense to me as far as being public servants. And like the opulence is just obscene. I mean, you see flowers flown in from Switzerland. And not to say that as Nigerians, we shouldn't have access to that level of wealth. But the problem for me that's going to hamper the sort of growth that only happens when wealth is distributed in a fashion that allows the majority of people to at least have access to thriving is not happening. And that's because of corruption. It is the biggest problem that we have, and it leads to the inability for very simple infrastructure problems to not get solved. Every single time I go to Nigeria, we don't have electricity for a 24-hour period without the use of a generator. So that means that if you are not a like reasonably wealthy person, you don't even have electricity. That is not okay in a society that is where some people are able to import their flowers from Switzerland. So I'll pause there. But Royfield, I hope that answers your question.
Bilal.
Thank you. And I just wanted to quickly respond to Ben with his analysis on China within Africa. First, I would agree with his assessment to an extent. I myself I've been to Mali, Senegal, South Sudan. I've been to Ethiopia, Kenya, Guinea-Bissau, and I'm also half Somali. So, you know, one thing I think that is missing, though, is that with the Chinese investment that is happening in Africa, one thing that the Chinese do is that they bring in all of their own contractors and their like local Chinese workers. And that causes a lot of tensions between the local Africans who are, let's say, unemployed or who are looking for the development and, let's say, between the Chinese workers. And there have actually been several incidences throughout several African countries of clashes between the two. And the second issue that I think some political leaders are kind of recognizing now, and we've seen the Chinese have started doing this, where a lot of that development seems like it comes no strings attached, right? But, you know, as soon as you either don't pay the loan or you get behind in the payments, then they'll start doing things like nationalizing your water infrastructure, nationalizing certain resources that your country has. And so we've seen in certain countries where the Chinese basically like have nationalized other people's resources, right? You know, that has also kind of cause some tensions between with certain African countries and the Chinese. It doesn't mean that the Chinese still doesn't have influence. They do. It doesn't mean that the Chinese are not still investing. They are. But I think that there are some underlying tensions, in particular between the workers and how that development is happening, that's causing a little bit more than which is kind of on the surface. And my final thing I would like to say is that President Obama in 2016 at the African Union had given a really, really good speech on the role of the United States in Africa, and in particular, competing with China. And he laid out in that speech several really good points, trying to basically advertise why the United States is better for business. I don't want to take up time, but I really recommend people look up that speech, because he lays out a lot of the points, and a lot of those things have started coming to fruition about 5 to 6 years later with what's happening with that relationship. So I'm Bilal, and I'm done speaking.
Thank you, Bilal. Dr. Terry Givens, you kind of specialize in looking at migration and immigrants around the world. Can you tell us some of the demographic pressures that Africa is going to experience in the next 20 years, and how that's going to affect the rest of the globe? But let's give us a wider spread in terms of population growth and migration and refugees specifically emanating from Africa.
So I mentioned this earlier today in a different room, but I think the biggest pressure is going to come from climate change. And because climate change is impacting so many countries, but there's also conflict, of course. So a lot of the movement of people, we're seeing people, well, there's the economic component, there's the conflict component, and then there's the climate change component. And, you know, in terms of the next 20 years globally, I just think we're going to see more and more movement of people. People are going to be trying to get away from places where there's flooding, places where the storms are getting worse, places where there's drought, and places where they can't get work. And they're going to want to go to, we're already seeing these flows into Europe, into the U.S., and those pressures are only going to increase. And the politics around it are very, very difficult in so many different ways. And so what we're seeing in Afghanistan right now with kind of a semi-reluctance to be willing to take a lot of refugees is going to be true going forward. So I think, some of the future conflicts are going to revolve potentially around immigration or migration from places, where, some people argue that even the Syrian conflict, originated with issues from climate change.
Correct.
Yes. So thank you. It's only because I do a lot of reading. I'm not a demographer per se, but I certainly pay attention to these things. And I just think the pressures from climate change are just going to push so many people to try to go to different places. And that's going to be a huge source of conflict.
Thank you, Dr. Terry. Mac, I'm going to come to you next, because I know that you're in Berlin. And after the Syrian civil war started, Germany took in 1 million Syrian immigrants. I know you haven't been in Berlin that long, maybe about a year or so, but could you kind of explain to us on the ground how the relatively new wave of Syrian migrants are viewed within Germany? How have they been integrated into society? But also, you're a recent migrant yourself from Canada. How does it feel to be a Canadian living in Berlin?
I guess I'll start by saying I'm an African immigrant to Canada. I'm actually a refugee. So I share a lot of commonality between the refugees here in Germany and all over Europe. But when it comes to how I'm treated compared to the Syrians and the other communities. Frankly, the Africans here are treated far different than the way that I'm treated. I don't speak German. I'm learning German, and people, I think most people make the assumption that I'm American because of the way that I speak. And it's not, the same treatment at all. I kind of feel like an expat, but most of the time, it's somewhere in the middle where there's this acceptance of me here as a Canadian, but also like I know that if I had immigrated here as a Somali refugee. And to just touch upon your question on how I feel as a Canadian in Berlin, it's been a little bizarre. I mean, I went to school in France, so I already had an understanding and just a cultural touchstone of what it's like to be Black in Europe. Berlin is not Germany. And if you only know Berlin, you really don't know Germany. Largely what I see in the Arab and Turkish communities who are really present here is there is a huge segregation. There are areas of the city where you just know you're walking into a community that's largely Turkish or largely Arab. And I think much of the Arab community who have been Lebanese and other communities from the Middle East, there are Syrians who work with them in the shops that they own. It seems everything on the surface, there's a veneer of normalcy and kind of, you know, people getting along. And this is Berlin, a very liberal place for the most part. But the segregation that's happening to me is, I mean, it's not simply the result of people wanting to stay within their communities. It's also the result of institutionalized racism. I don't see that the Syrians have been really integrated into society. You hear many, you know, success stories, but largely when it comes to how they've been accepted in the country, they haven't been. There's a huge resentment that's growing across the country and within Berlin, definitely. There's areas of Berlin that if you're Black, you just don't go there. There's one neighborhood called Marzahn. It's in East Berlin. And there's an IKEA located there that I went to because it was the closest IKEA to where I lived. But I always felt extremely uncomfortable knowing that, you know, were I not just coming here for the shop, this is not a place that I could really just frequent and feel at ease. So there are effective no-go zones for people of color, certainly for Black people. I think that Syrians have had a very different acceptance into the community compared to their Turkish counterparts who have been here for three or four generations. The Turkish here are very established. The Syrians are not. They're still, you know, a refugee community. Many of them who came to the country were extremely young, you know, school-age children. And I think they're still going through their integration process and also just trying to, you know, just graduate school and get jobs. I think there's a lot of good things happening, but the German community, of course, have not fully accepted their presence here.
Britain obviously Brexited from Europe. There was an election in 2016 and 52% of Britons decided to leave the EU. And at the heart of that, there were fundamentally two issues, a fear of immigration, but also a distrust of political institutions, i.e. the EU and governance not being at the national level. How have we seen our distrust of institutions play out within the US? Let's go to you, AB.
Yeah, and honestly, I think this is something that's been brewing for quite some time. I mean, since Reagan in the 80s, you've had, you know, a growing contempt within the right for government institutions, or at least at the very least, a suspicion about government and big government. And slowly it's eroded that trust that we have. And of course, Donald Trump is, you know, he did his part in fanning the flames. So at this point going forward, I have to say, yes, like we're at a point where if I don't know if this is actually done on a poll or not, but I'd have to say that a great majority of Americans do have a great distrust towards government and their institutions, be it media, be it a lot of things. And that fracturing, that distrust, I think it's not healthy for social cohesion, nor is it for, you know, anything moving forward, especially when it comes to be it politics or, you know, social relationships.
Aram, we've basically established that there is this distrust. This distrust is all throughout the liberal world in terms of us looking at tried and tested institutions of governance, and we're now much more skeptical about it. We're trying to look 20 years into the future. How can we get trust back into our institutions?
You threw me the softball, huh? You know, I think that one of the largest parts of what we face, and I really think this is just governance all around, is that there hasn't been a whole lot of honesty about where we stand and what the sort of most important things are that we face. I mean, I want to echo what Dr. Terry was saying about the, you know, the overwhelming importance of climate change. Just staying in the U.S. for a second, we have one of the most populated states in the country where the majority of people live in a place where within a generation or two, it's unlikely to be habitable. And that's not even something that's, really being addressed or spoken to directly. There's been a lot of promises that were made about whether it was prosperity or, what life would look like that weren't met. And there's been a lot of manipulation and corruption that's happened at the same time that there's been much more transparency that's been created by media, by the internet, but, just by living in this more connected world. And so I think that the tolerance that people have and that governments can, so sort of what governments can get away with in today's society is just much less. And so the standard of governance needs to go way up very quickly. And I'm not sure that we can actually meet the challenge in the time that we need to. But pretty soon we're not going to have much of a choice. I think we will see a lot of places that, or a lot more places, I should say, that are just going to be completely destabilized. And that's going to increase the pressure for better governance. And I really fear what that's going to look like.
Kelly, is Aaron right that things have to get worse for them to get better in terms of us having trust in our institutions? We saw on January the 6th what the distrust in one of the most fundamental elements of democracy, the vote and collating the vote, actually what that can actually do. But is Aaron right if we look in 20 years into the future that things have to get worse before they get better? Or can we try and build that trust in our institutions? And let's start with America. Can we do that now before things get any worse?
I imagine there are some things we could do to start rebuilding trust. But honestly, I do think Aram's right about things getting worse before they get better. I don't know that we would agree on why that is or the things that need to change. But I think that our constituency has to do it. And I think that's going to take time. We have to understand that we have a responsibility to pay attention to our government and to who we elect. And until we do that, we're not going to be able to expect anything better.
Let's stay with America before we go back into the world. Immediately, what does this defeat at Kabul mean for American domestic politics and then for American foreign politics? Lola.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to kick us off with an observation that I think relates to Bilal bringing up the media. I think one of the implications domestically is what some might characterize, and I being one of them, false validation for the Republican Party around our current president's inability to control situations. So that's A. And then the second part of your question, what is the global implication of that? I think it just makes this moment even more fraught with a question of what is our ability to positively impact the humanitarian aspects of specifically the issue in Afghanistan, and what is going to be the decision whether or not we lean into that to the extent that we should. How is that going to be influenced by the political tensions that are currently arising?
I don't know. I'm very skeptical that this is going to have any long-term impact. I think that people haven't thought much about Afghanistan. And in a year when, we're looking at the election, I don't think that foreign policy is going to be high on the agenda for most voters. I just think that, in another month or two, we're just going to forget. And that seems to be look at how easily and quickly we forgot about Syria. You don't hear anybody, talking about what's going on in Syria. And I think foreign policy has just become such an incredibly low priority for Americans and to a certain extent for Europeans as well. And I think, we're not going to take in, we're going to take in some Afghans. We're not going to take in a huge number of Afghans. And I just have a hard time seeing how this has long-term impact because and it's partly my skepticism and pessimism, but also just the fact that Afghanistan just doesn't seem to be that important for most people.
Rebecca for the blacks. Surely, when the dust settles on this, I'm going to disagree with Dr. Terry here. When the dust settles on this, hard questions are going to be asked in the Defense Department in terms of the amount of money that America spends on military material. America spends what the next 20 countries combined spend on its military. That's how disproportionate it is to every other country, even China. It massively outspends China. Surely, if America is slowly but surely retreating militarily from the rest of the world, the military industrial complex needs to pay that price. It needs to be reduced.
Yeah, I would have to, I mean, I adore Dr. Terry, but I would have to disagree. I think that we're coming up on 20 years of 9/11. So 9/11 always represents a reboot to towards patriotism, love of country. This is who, you know, this is who America is. You know, this happened to us, never again. So that's a, you know, like a clock, you know, it happens at 12 o'clock, you know, it's ding, 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 you know. So I think that that is a reset that kind of whips people out of rational thought and back into emotionality, right? So whether the normal tide of, you know, the ebb and flow of, oh, we care, oh, we don't care, you know, sale for Black Friday or Thanksgiving or Christmas or something, I think that it's coming up on the 20-year anniversary. So this is colossal in terms of really giving America an introspection as to what the hell have we done and what we're going to do moving forward. I was a part of the Occupy movement, and we used to always talk about defense contractors, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, right? And I challenge anyone right now to go look at the defense national budget. It's a pie chart, and like 2/3 of it is for defense. One tiny, 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 you might need a microscope sliver, or you might really need to like zoom in with your fingers on your touchscreen to look at the education budget. It's like 3%. It might be 4% now. Don't hold me to it, but it's like literally 3 or 4%. And then when we look at the budget, the defense budget, that also includes defense contractors. It includes all of these so-called advisors that didn't know like that Al-Qaeda was doing what they're doing. So, you know, this is padding the wallet of a lot of, and I'll say this again, men that are over there, right? So who was packed on that plane? Now, mind you, I heard that plane was like over capacity by over 100 people. Like it was overweight. It was way too many people. So who knows about COVID protocols on that plane? But outside of that, it was all men. So to what degree, you know, are we looking at the weapons manufacturers? Are we looking at the defense contractors? Are we looking at these bloated budgets? And in Occupy, we always used to say, who do you protect? Who do you serve?
Can I just say something really quickly, if I can jump in quickly? I just want to be clear that just because the United States is pulling back on Afghanistan does not necessarily equate to a reduction of defense spending, right? So I think the defense budget, to my knowledge, has actually not reduced. And I think what is happening is that there's just kind of like a reallocation of resources around the world. Like I think about when Obama wanted to do his quote unquote pivot towards Asia, right? And he wanted to basically strengthen the South China Sea. And he wanted to basically have a new kind of strategic defense partnership to kind of like offset the rise of China. You know, that's what they were thinking about, getting away from the Middle East. Pretty much were redeploying resources. You know, right before he left office, they had put NATO troops right on, I think, if I'm not mistaken, NATO borders to offset, let's say, Russian aggression. And then also there might be reallocation of resources towards 21st century types of defense, whether it comes to cyber crimes and things like that. So I don't want it to, you know, to be any like mistake that they're thinking that just because you're leaving one actor or you're leaving one region, that the money's going to reallocate it towards, let's say, more social programs, domestic products. To my knowledge, unless I see something differently, the defense budget is still at the same level. It's just shuffling the decks and moving to another part, another region of the world. So,
but on that point, though, Bilal, and anyone can feel free to chime in with this, the way that America has rapidly pulled out of Afghanistan, and there has been an overwhelming desire for the last 12 years, in the halls of American foreign power in its embassies, which is a desire to retreat. How strong is American commitment today to Taiwan? How strong today is American commitment to maintain all of its bases in South Korea? How strong is American commitment to maintain its massive military presence in Okinawa? So there are three countries, if we say that Taiwan is a country, for the sake of this argument, it is. How strong is that commitment? The American people are tired of these foreign entanglements.
Those aren't foreign entanglements. Those are ways that we maintain our presence in Asia, which I don't think is going away.
But I also think, though...
Hold on. There were some facts that were misidentified in terms of budget. My name is Alex, and I'm coming to you from the traditional lands of the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabek, which is Toronto, Ontario. The facts are, someone did say that U.S. defense spending is up. It's up about to $730 billion from $670 approximately the year before. But it's not, the pie chart is not a third or half or two-thirds defense. Defense of the total outlays of $4.4 trillion, defense is $730 billion roughly, let's say this year, which puts it behind Social Security, slightly ahead of Medicare, and about double what Medicaid is. So I think if we're going to talk about progressive issues and we're going to say, hey, defense spending needs to decrease because it's bloated, it's out of proportion in comparison with other countries, which it is, we can't go and be hyperbolous about the facts of what they actually are.
Thanks, Alex. I'm so sorry. I had already put the defense budget in my PTR prior to you speaking.
But yeah, also, Alex, just a little bit of context. I mean, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security are like entitlement spending, right? Where defense spending is more considered, I don't know if the term is discretionary. So I guess in the context, you kind of need to see defense spending within this context of, let's say, education or social program, like other spending, because those entitlement programs are like fixed in. But I don't want to kind of get off track with that. I think Rossfield had asked a question about the military bases around the world. I think what's really important is that I agree with you that the Americans are tired of basically foreign entanglements, right? But I think what they're tired of is the fact that they're seeing that, like, their own lives, let's say, haven't improved over the last, let's say, 10, 15, 20 years while we have been tied up around the world. And I'm talking about, like, very basic needs, whether it's, like, infrastructure, you know, rising cost of education, inequality. And I think Americans are saying, well, my life itself is not improving, but yet I'm seeing all this money being spent abroad. Why is my money going over there when I can't get to work without a pothole like destroying my car and me having to pay $700 to get repairs? Like, I think it's a very microeconomic connection that they see. And I think one of the most important things that America can do, and frankly speaking, that like democracies can do around the world, is to prove that governments can still work. I actually think, like, this is an argument that Joe Biden made at the G7 that I kind of think went under the radar, was that when he went to the G7, he said, guys, we still have to prove that, like, democracy actually can work tangibly to change the lives of people, whether it's addressing climate change, addressing infrastructure, things like that. Because if we prove that it doesn't work, then people will be more likely to say, hey, you know what? We're going to go with the dictator. We're going to go with the totalitarian. We're okay with having Trump in power for, let's say, 10, 20, 30 years if I can get my dang blasted pothole fixed. So I think it's like very like micro things that, you know, government needs to do to prove it can still function.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And America has just unequivocally proven that democracy is not something that it can export and can prove that is better for the lives of foreigners. I mean, the U.S. foreign policy resources have been completely wasted on chauvinist ideals and like punching down while China's enriching itself through the Belt and Road Initiative. It's debt trap diplomacy for sure, but it's still putting money in the hands of poor countries, even momentarily. And just as Bilal referenced the G7, they also announced a copycat initiative of the Belt and Road, which is, I think it's called Build Back Better. I mean, I know it was like compounding elements like the pandemic, China is so economically powerful, I read that in 2020, China is like pretty much the only country that whose economy grew during the first year of the pandemic. I just can't understate, just the ineptitude of like NGOs in Africa and in developing countries. Like these are unfortunately many people who just bide their time in African countries before like hoping to angle for more influential or better paying jobs or just simply better located positions in more cushy countries. Like the UN in the eyes of Africans and people in the global South, it's just one of like ghost colonialism. You know, they show up where there are disasters and there's humanitarian crises. But those crises in, are born of interventionism and colonialism. And China comes along, gives people money in their hands, whereas European, autocrats and elite were doing that to a few corrupt people in the ruling class or factions who are like vying for power. But there's been nowhere near the amount of actual infrastructure building as there have been by like, other foreign powers, not just China, like Turkey's in Somalia, the Gulf countries like Qatar and the UAE are fighting proxy wars with Turkey in many African countries. And instead of like, dropping bonds, they've been spending money.
And let's just slightly move this away from America. We've seen the flashpoint of the West's defeat in Afghanistan, and the ripples of that will be manifest and will last for years. But you're a student of geopolitics, Piotr. Where will we see the next global emergency?
Taiwan is a concern. The South China Sea is a concern, given the continued encroachment of the CCP on the island and what we've seen in Hong Kong over the past couple of years. Taiwan is the next point. But I think it's very interesting because what we've seen in terms of the US, the UK and allies, when they're going through the South China Sea, a couple of weeks ago when HMS Queen Elizabeth went through the South China Sea, there was a lot of posturing and call outs from the CCP, given that they think that any foreign military ship is trespassing within their backyard when it's actually freedom of navigation. Now, as I say, that the CCP mainly just shadowed the ships. It was a small entity of an aircraft carrying a couple of destroyers, I think. But that's about as far as it went. And I think it was quite indicative of the fact that the CCP are beginning to feel a little bit rattled. And they're not the most popular country in the world. They're increasingly isolated. What we saw with this 100-year anniversary and the way that they held the process and the way Xi Jinping was dressed as to sort of, commemorate Mao in such a evident way. For me, it was chilling to watch that. Now, obviously, given what's happened in Afghanistan, this has changed the narrative quite a lot, and it might have emboldened the CCP again, given that they were the first country to actually acknowledge the Taliban as a legitimate replacement, not necessarily just immediately government, but just sort of, those new in charge of Afghanistan. I would say that, we're going to have to be conscious of how Taiwan continues to resist the CCP's desire for it to align to their values and way of structuring, you know, a state. The one thing I would say is that there's a difference between taking Taiwan and keeping Taiwan. We've seen a lot of increased over the past couple of days Chinese PLA military activities. So, you know, I don't want to hasten too much conjecture on what could happen out there, but it is somewhere that I'm always constantly quite worried about. Other than that region, I mean, there's improvements in the Venezuelan situation, I hope. Africa, I mean, Tigray could spill over into a regional issue.
That this is Mid-Atlantic, the podcast, which looks at primarily US and UK news and views. But we do take in news from around the world. And very obviously, that's what we've done today. So the podcast has been running for some 7 years. If you're listening in the audience, why don't you go into a podcast of your choice after the end of this room, type in Mid-Atlantic, and you'll see a whole lot of shows. And last week, we had Soledad O'Brien. So we're trying to kind of mix things up here on the show and get not only people who are incredibly informed, but also kind of people who've helped kind of deliver the news to kind of explain their view of the news as well. So that's us. Also, hit the little green house and become a member of Mid-Atlantic. So whenever we go live with these rooms, you can join us. Now, what we're going to do now is going to invite people on stage. What has happened in Kabul is much more significant than the fall of Saigon. The Americans should never have been in Vietnam, and they lost a war basically fought around hubris that had little immediate geopolitical effect on American prestige and American material, that fall in Saigon. This is completely different because it points to a retreat of American power, the projection of power throughout the world. This is completely different. This is completely different in terms of scale. But we don't want to just bang on about Afghanistan or America. We want to look at how the world is going to be changed by the fact there won't be a unipolar world anymore. I think this is incredibly important. And we need to look at China and Taiwan, as Piotr has said, and maybe there are bits of the world of which this retreat of American power is going to be incredibly significant for. So we've called on stage Beautiful Farrell and Ben, and we have Mustafa, who we've just invited on stage.
Real quick, before you get to introducing the new people, who I'm sure have been waiting patiently, I actually wanted to give a quick hot take on where I actually think the next world hotspot is going to be, the next conflict. I actually think East Africa, which right now is very much rife with ethnic conflict, and particularly in Tigray, where my mother's from. But in the backdrop of that is actually the Great Renaissance Dam has been a point of contention, primarily between Ethiopia, Sudan, and Egypt, with Egypt being probably the more aggressive of the parties. So they are speaking of military intervention if Ethiopia doesn't concede to their demands regarding the dam. It would not shock me if as soon as the Tigray conflict is resolved or something comes to it in terms of finding some type of resolution within the government. Once that is done, Egypt and Ethiopia could very much be going at it. And I think that could definitely cause a domino effect, not just within the region, but other powers that are involved.
Donna, you unmuted.
I agree with AB. Not just even when the conflict in Tigray ends, I mean, even potentially before it ends, depending on how long it goes on. I mean, there's been so much tension. I think now we're seeing it more, but I remember one of my trips there in 2013 and just the rhetoric going back and forth between Ethiopia and Egypt, you know, over the GERD in the very early stages, which was only, a year or two in, I think, of the construction. So I absolutely agree with you. I think there's so much happening in the Horn right now, and I think it's definitely a place that people should watch.
Can anybody else point the finger at another potential flashpoint? So we've had the South China Sea, we've had China and Taiwan, with potentially the CCP kind of flexing its muscles there. AB has brought up the Horn of Africa. We know that there is this conflict in Tigray, but specifically there is this major potential conflict between Egypt and Ethiopia over this dam. Ben Mendelsohn.
Two things. One is a possible flashpoint, Israel and Iran, two nuclear powers, or one potentially nuclear power. That's a problem, and that's a flashpoint. But more generally, it's something that none of us have brought up that I think we need to look at. There have been all of the pandemic is a mega event. It changed, particularly in the United States and in the West. Everything stopped for a long period, for a period of time. And 9/11 was a mega event. The 2008-2010 depression in the United States was a mega event. The world stopped for at least a week. World War II was a mega event. My feeling is that the mega events have been happening every 10, 15 years. It's going to start accelerating. It's going to be a mega event every 5 years instead of every 10 years. Some of that is going to be caused by climate change and climate issues. But I think the one that we haven't even talked about and we haven't put our head around is cyber warfare. When the cyber attack happened and they kind of shut down the power plants, that was, you know, just a small taste of the destruction that could happen. It's not the destruction, the disruption that could happen that could literally close down portions of the world that, you know, that we won't essentially going to be in triage until we get these things fixed in some constant effective triage. Yeah, I'm thinking every 5 years we're going to have something like this and we better get used to it.
I think that's an excellent point, Ben. And I've always been surprised by the Russian attack on the government of Estonia. It was about 2010, 2011, where they gummed up all of the state computers. So the government of Estonia could not function for 2 days. This seems to have been forgotten by the general populace, that fundamentally a NATO member, the government was crippled by a foreign actor, Russia. We know who did it, and the response was just about mute from NATO and from the rest of the world. So I completely and utterly agree that cyber is going to be one of the future platforms of war. Terry, you unmuted.
It's very interesting to me. We've talked about a lot of different areas of the world, but we have not talked about Latin America. And I think there are going to be some major issues. Conflict in Latin America going, you know, in the near future that will, you know, end up pulling in the U.S. potentially. But I think we, you know, climate change is impacting, as well as just what's going on, you know, in places like Venezuela. I think we're going to see more conflict coming because of climate change and demographics and movements of people in Latin America. So I don't want to ignore one huge area of the world that I think is going to have a huge impact.
You are right. And Latin America generally gets forgotten about in kind of geopolitics or climate concerns. We've had an economic implosion in Venezuela, which has meant that millions of Venezuelans have left in the last 3 years. It's put massive pressure on Colombia, on Ecuador, the neighboring countries. But also, we've seen this kind of gradual replacement of the Amazon rainforest by savanna in eastern Amazonia as well. So the risk of the loss of biodiversity is absolutely paramount in South America. Piotr.
No, I think Dr. Terry, who we had gratefully on during our room earlier and gave some fantastic insights, is very astute with her point about Latin America, of which also is unrepresented on Clubhouse. I rarely see rooms focused on Latin American current affairs. I think that given the work that I did with Amnesty around the time of the Venezuelan constitutional crisis, I think that, I mean, as of today, I'm glad that the there was a report the sides are going to actually finally begin negotiations, but it doesn't mean that the country is going to be, you know, returning to a state of stability. The currency is absolutely shot and the economy has been so badly affected by that and then COVID. But the thing for me that is it could be a trigger point is the effect of the humanitarian migration that has been, you know, pressuring so many of the other surrounding states, particularly Colombia. And given the only in 2016 when the Colombian peace deal was signed, there's been civil unrest in the country as well, unrelated to that. But I just feel that there's quite a lot of elements that could boil over and we could see a potential deterioration in the sort of northern part of South America, you know, between Colombia, Venezuela, if things don't go well with the current, you know, administration. But as to say what time frame, it's a little bit difficult.
Go on, Shireen.
Yeah, thank you. There were a couple that I wanted to say really quickly, but I do want to go back to the cyber war part. I think there was a really missing conversation there. I mean, to be really honest, and that's just across the board. That isn't like even what happened in with our grids here in America is not being discussed publicly the way it should be, including the hacks that have happened, and what that means for our systems. Because if you do some overlays on where these attacks have happened over the year, there's some testing beds going on that I think we're not paying attention to, and that's just America, but that doesn't count what may be happening in other countries. I honestly feel like it's one of the biggest pieces that we're not talking about enough. And I think mostly because most people don't get it politically or how they operate and overlap between the hacking versus the access to the grids, the ransomware conversations that I think sometimes we're not talking about enough of, that really talks about the ways in which governments are being held hostage over these types of systems. So I just wanted to make sure that was an important part of this conversation. But the other part in terms of global, that I want to make sure that is also included, is that I honestly think we're downplaying what might be happening in terms of either conflict or consolidation between the Taliban, ISIS, and other groups. I think that there is a missing conversation there. I also think that there is a missing conversation, the Saudi Arabia framework and Pakistan in connection to what's happened in Afghanistan. So those are just some key things I just wanted to put on the table, because I just think that there's some missing conversations there.
Thank you for that. We now have a lot of people on stage. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to call upon people who actually haven't spoken. And the thread of the conversation might be slightly be lost, but I know people have been waiting patiently to speak for the last hour. So first I'm going to call on Dr. Moisha McAfee. Doctor, where do you sit with our conversation? Please tell us.
Hi, I'm Dr. Moisha McAfee, and I want to enter the conversation not only as a social scientist, but also as an initiated healer. And I think that when I hear the thread of conversation that's moving more toward naming the conflicts that are currently happening, but also the ones where we expect something to arise, it brings up for me these huge questions around what would the First Peoples and Indigenous people interpret about what's happening now. And I'm specifically thinking about the specific traditions that I am from and the southern part of Africa, as well as the western part. And when we see things like this level of war and conflict, this level of destabilization that's happening, this level of economies, you know, the haves versus the economies that don't have, and particularly thinking about China and the way that it's using its resources to infiltrate through borrowing to nations that are still looking to build. When I think about, I think the last number I saw was, I think it was like 107 fires in 15 different states, at least in the U.S., and not even considering the other places. The ways that First Peoples and Indigenous peoples would interpret that is that there's something that human beings of this generation and maybe even our ancestors, where we're not in right relationship with something divine, whether that's right relationship with the earth in terms that we call climate change. But I think First Peoples or Indigenous peoples would talk about, are we in right relationship with nature? Are we in right relationship with the spirits of the water, with the spirits of the wind, with the spirits of the earth? And what might we need to shift to do to be in right relationship? Which is a different and maybe more expanded conversation than climate change, or the things people hear with a certain ear and may or may not actually be attuned to it. And also when we think about the ways that these destabilizing economies and nations are happening, even with the civil wars or the way genocide is being played out, to think about not only on the earthly plane, how might we be navigating these? But I think also as an initiated healer, there's also stuff that's happening on the ancestral plane that and the spiritual plane that is needed to be worked out. And so I want to bring to a policy conversation, to an economic conversation, to a global conversation, the ways that there are First Nation Indigenous knowledge and traditions, whether they're ancestral wisdom or ancient practices, that I think could inform and complement the dialogue. I'm Dr. Mayusha, and I'm done speaking.
Thank you, Dr. Mayusha. We're going through to people who haven't spoken. Beautiful flower.
Yes, thank you, Royfield. With the fall of Kabul, if I also relate it back to the charter that's coming out of Nigeria, especially with the Northern Nigeria that is somewhat sympathetic to the sect in Taliban, and it's problematic because the social media post, I think the takeover of the Taliban is sending this message to the Boko Haram and the ISWAP problem we have in Northern Nigeria, and also the social media posting they've been doing all day. And so I guess it's more of, oh, you know, your ideology will conquer. Just bid your time. Lay low. That's very problematic, actually. And also the problem with the Shias in Nigeria, their leader actually was released. Again, the government is trying to go back in and try him. So we have different sects, the Sunni, of course, backed by the kingdom, and also Iran funding the Shia in Nigeria. And so these are the things that I'm currently looking at, but I'll come back around. I have many thoughts. Thank you, Royfield.
No, thank you, beautiful flower. Just before you go, just remind us who Boko Haram are and some of the atrocities that they've been associated with in Northern Nigeria, please.
Thank you. So Boko Haram started in Nigeria in 2008-2009, and Boko Haram simply means Western education is something. I've forgotten, but I'll look it up. Basically, it's just to push back on Western ideology. They kidnap girls, kidnap school children. In Northern Nigeria, this is a terrorist group actually funded by, by ISIL sometimes, and then they have a different body, ISWAP. They've taken over a particular state in Nigeria. The citizens actually pay taxes for protection. So they mimic the same ideology with ISIL and some of the Taliban. We currently in Nigeria have a communications minister whose video leaked on social media. His name is Issa Pantami, who in the past made comments, actually praised Osama bin Laden. So you can see the ties, and it's, again, very problematic, actually. He didn't resign even when those videos surfaced. I don't know why. And we can see a rise, actually, in this extremist cells, if as we call them. They are overwhelmingly powerful, really. They keep going to the Al-Shabaab in Sudan. Some sects, actually, it's not just one of them.
Somalia, not Sudan. Yeah, Shabaab in Somalia.
Somalia, sorry. For training. And then when they come back, they sort of reinforce. We also have the same issue with captured Boko Haram terrorists. They claim they've been rehabilitated, and then once the Nigerian army, releases them back to the public under the guise that they've been rehabilitated, they go right back. And so, it's just so similar, because we know the leader.
Very similar. And it shows you how interconnected all of these things are, because a victory for the Taliban gives extra impetus to Boko Haram in northern Nigeria. Hadjia, thank you for that correction. You've waited so long. Please tell us where you come in on this conversation. Pharrell, you're up next, sir.
Thank you. So I'm gonna focus on the cyber warfare, and I'll roll it back to why it's related to Kabul. The comments in the room that were made here in that cyber warfare will be, or this or that. It is. It absolutely is. When you look at war, when you look at a battle strategy, you look at what your high ground is. You look at your opportunity to win the battle, to win the war. That high ground, space is a high ground, but the real high ground is cyber warfare. It's the internet. It's the intranets. It's the dark web. It's the other environments that you don't know about. The battle rages. We are in a worldwide war. We've been in this war for quite a while. It's been getting more and more and more aggressive, more open. There's been events that have occurred in the United States that people said, hey, it's hackers, it's this, that. When Cisco got hit, it didn't even make the public news the way it did for the given oil company. That all the cyber defense contractors, the chatter going on, it was very clear that it was state-sponsored. But nobody wanted to go to war over it because there's no money in it at this point. There's no preparedness for it. There's the talk about China, Taiwan. I could dive into this deep, but I will roll this backwards to Kabul. So you have these conversations of the modern day elements left over from the Mujahideen and what the U.S. originally failed to do to respect that whole relationship, which then potentially, if you want to argue, gave birth to the Taliban. And all of this has evolved into modern warfare. And modern warfare is in the cyberspace. The Taliban, ISIS, every single actor in the world that wants to have control, power, or do harm, whether it's in a given space, or regional space, or globally, they have to act within the cyberspace. They have to do it. If they don't, they're not a player. When a unit for the U.S. military, the Canadian military, the British, whoever, when they go in, they're not going in just because they've got aircraft or they've got this or they've got that. Their cyber intelligence, their cyber actions have led the way. That's the pathfinder. So in the case of the Taliban, you can't kid yourself thinking that they are not highly sophisticated. They are extremely sophisticated. Their hacker core is fairly capable. And they are working for their own end goal. So what will happen with Kabul, or because of Kabul? Well, now you've got a Taliban force that now has a whole bunch of military assets that have been provided to the Afghan government and been left over from the exit that's rapidly happening, because none of the gear that's dropped there comes back. There's no capability to do that, or the money or care to do it. It's easier to leave the gear there. So now you've got a much more capable force on the hard asset element, and they've got cyber capability. So the cyber capability will start to embolden the entire terrorist network and whatever other elements support that from whatever other direction. As it was stated, it's a very complicated environment. It is an absolute web, no pun intended, to the internet. But the cyber warfare activity is absolutely raging. And the only reason that entire countries haven't collapsed is because the defense architecture in countries like the United States, Canada, UK, China, etc. They are constantly fighting each other. If you were to look at some of the things that you can potentially see out there, you would see that this is an all-out war that's going on, and we're just thankful, just be thankful it hasn't shifted to state against state warfare on an open field with military. We're at the cusp of that, but thankfully we haven't gone there. So the cyber warfare is definitely raging.
Alexa, where'd you come in on this conversation?
Hi. I am thinking about some of the climate change issues and the impact that that is going to have. There's a group that we're doing for Mother Earth First tomorrow on the designing for climate calamities and the Maldives and the islands and the likelihood that, you know, they will be covered by water, and where are those in all the rooms she goes into, she'll ask where, who's going to take us, who's going to take us into their country. And I think that that is, as we deal with climate crisis and change in weather systems and a lot of people displaced, what are we going to do and how are we going to manage that? So that's been on my mind a lot. And I'm not sure kind of how people are thinking about that or addressing that issue. So thank you.
Thank you for that, Alexa. I know Dr. Terry did talk about climate change and how that's going to help push this kind of migrant emergency. But yes, specifically in the Indian Ocean and in the Pacific, it's incredibly urgent. Some of these small island nations are literally sinking as we speak. They only have about 50 years left before they're going to be underwater. So it's good for you to bring that up. So very obviously, you had a multiplicity of views of people quite literally all around the world talking about some of the threats that the world is going to face in the next 20 years. What I'd like you to do is to email in to the show and quite simply go on to midatlanticshow.com, hit contact us, and tell us some of the areas which you think we have neglected to talk about. It feels incredibly dystopian. We're at a crisis point, an inflection point with this rapid American withdrawal from Afghanistan and the collapse of the Afghan government. But I think you can actually see some of the links which can be made with other conflicts around the world. We had somebody who spoke from Northern Nigeria who explained that the rise of the Taliban, again, actually what that does to Boko Haram within Northern Nigeria. So these elements might feel incredibly unconnected, but they all actually are. I'm somebody who's from Jamaican parentage in Birmingham. My brother is an Afghan. He was born in Kandahar and was adopted by my family in 2007. He was a refugee. He escaped because at that point, the secular forces in Afghanistan were coming after his father. His father was a member of the Taliban. He hates the Taliban, but his uncle told him to get out of Afghanistan, and he was smuggled to the UK. So on a very personal level, I'm touched by what is going on in Afghanistan. And we all are migrants somewhere. We all are the children of conflict. You might have to go back one or two generations, but we all are, and we all should be concerned and be connected to what's actually happened in Afghanistan today. So that's been Mid-Atlantic. I'm so sorry it feels dystopian, but we are going to continue the conversation after the podcast. If you would like to be in the audience for one of these shows, quite simply, all you need to do is download the Clubhouse app, find Mid-Atlantic, the club, become a member, then you'll be alerted when we go live. Or you can give me a follow. You know my name, it's Roy Field. Give me a follow, and then basically you can be alerted when I do these shows as well. Love to see you as part of the audience for the show. And don't forget, folks, left of center politics is right thinking politics. Take care, look after yourselves, and look after your loved ones even better.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.